Okay, In the Wilderness, part two. Part one, we went over the majority of Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12 is quite an amazing chapter. I think some brethren have called that the backbone of Revelation. It's one of the first things that Brother Russell wanted the brethren to understand. And he wrote, Brother Russell wrote two very meaty articles. They're the Brother A, Brother B discussions. Reprint 54, and also reprint 304. That's 304. And they are both entitled The Antichrist. So for the references, that's a key one. Another reference that is very, very good is called, it's a book I was privileged to read not too long ago. It was called The Reformers and Their Stepchildren. The Reformers and Their Stepchildren. And it gives a whole lot of history about the 1260 years that we were talking about yesterday. That's mentioned twice in Revelation 17. It's by a fellow named Leonard Verduin, V-E-R-D-U-I-N, Verdun or Verduin or whatever. But the Reformers and their stepchildren. He was not a Bible student, but you could clearly see understanding Revelation 12 and what it means. You read this history, and he documents things very, very thoroughly. He actually did a lot of research in Europe, went over there, went all over Europe, looked at old court records from the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. And we'll be quoting a few things from that book, but it gives you a lot of insight. And, of course, knowing what Revelation 12 is really about, and you read the history, you can put things together, and it really has given me much better insight. Now, some errata. One thing I misspoke yesterday was about Constantine moving the seat of government of the Roman Empire to Constantinople. That didn't happen in 1334. That happened in 334. So sometimes you have to use a little filter for the one who's speaking from the platform. Okay, well, yesterday, what we want to come up with, really come down to, is this idea of uniformity in religion. The Roman Empire demanded uniformity in religion. That was how they had control. They wanted to control the people mentally with religion. And, of course, control them absolutely with the power of the empire through the emperor. And the emperor was Pontifex Maximus. And as Will Durant had said, for the Roman, he saw that his pagan religion was really a manifestation of the state. So the state and the religion really were one. And they were intertwined, and they were inseparable, completely inseparable. And we're going to see an example of this in the scriptures because we'll see that very clearly. But we want to take a look and say, what does this really mean? Well, we all know the story of the three Hebrews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are their Babylonian names. But in Daniel 3:5, and these were three Hebrews who were trying to be very, keep their religion, be faithful to the one true God. Well, in Daniel 3:5-6, they were told, when you hear the sound of the cornet and all this music, you're going to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, was this an image of Nebuchadnezzar? I don't know. But it was certainly something that represented the God that everybody was supposed to worship. And if it didn't represent Nebuchadnezzar himself, then it would at least represent the God that was guiding and directing the emperor. So you had to worship that God, and in doing that, you're showing support for the emperor because the religion and the state work together and inseparable. So when there's all this music, you're supposed to fall down and worship this in Daniel 3:6, and whoso falleth not down will be cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So if you're wondering if this is obligatory, yes, it is. And hopefully everybody would get the point. You must do this. This is not optional. Well, in reprint 4874, Brother Russell mentions, all would be expected to fall down and worship and reverence the image which Nebuchadnezzar that which represented Nebuchadnezzar in that it represented his God, or the God who was guiding and blessing him. And not to do so would show disloyalty, ingratitude, treason. So here's a religious act. If you didn't do it, it's seen as treason. Well, note that the decision on the part of the three Hebrews showed their preference or choice in religious worship. But the expression of that choice was seen as a traitorous act, which challenged the authority and the power of the absolute autocrat, the emperor. Now notice, they didn't challenge the empire. In fact, they were ministers in the empire. They were enforcing the laws of the empire. They were doing the will of the empire. But they said, well, we'll do that. We're working for the government. But it's this religion that they say I have to have. We can't abide by that. We can't do that. So, the idea was they weren't supposed to have any choices in religion. Nebuchadnezzar in that empire said, here's what your religion will be. And they said, no, we have to make a choice. Now notice, what they were doing was exactly what every Jew should have done. Every Jew should have said, we cannot bow down and worship this idol. Every Jew should have done this. But we only know about the three Hebrews. Daniel was apparently not there, or else we would have heard about him too. But several centuries later, Jesus put this into words. He says, render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. Now, think about what he just said. If you take the way Gentile government was, it was religion, empire together, intertwined, inseparable, absolutely no way to get them apart. And Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and under God the things that are God's. And Jesus has now just ripped those concepts apart from one another. This was incomprehensible to the Roman mind. But he says, this is what you have to do. Well, Nebuchadnezzar and everyone else made no distinction between state and religion. They were all the same. Nebuchadnezzar was the Pontifex Maximus. He was the chief religious ruler or the chief priest, and this had to be acknowledged by all the people. But the three Hebrews go in the fiery furnace. Well, later Nebuchadnezzar says, well, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and the fourth is like the Son of God. We took note of this. Well, Daniel 3:29 says, let every people know that if anybody speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they will be cut in pieces. So this God has attention. He realizes, you know, their God is a very powerful God. I mean, he's a real God. He's not just one of these goofy things our priests cook up and they have some hocus pocus, something where they light off a fire or do some magic trick and overawes the people. This is something real. And he realized that. Now, it didn't motivate him to become a Jew, but really from that time on, the Jews were exempted from this forced uniformity of religion. And that exemption would go all the way through the Roman Empire. All four universal empires would exempt the Jews. Now, not completely. There would be persecutions against the Jews and whatnot from time to time. But for the most part, they would say, okay, Jews can stay Jews, but everybody else has to have the religion of the empire. So, these Jews were tolerated, as long as they caused no problems. Well, let's go back to the law at Sinai. We've looked at the Gentile governments and how they treated people and the uniformity they were expecting. Now let's take a look at the true religion in Exodus 19 and 20. Exodus 20 verse 3, thou shalt have no other gods before me. So God, the one true God, also wanted uniformity in religion. He didn't want the one true religion to simply be the majority religion, but to be the only religion amongst Israel. But this was the true religion. It was for Israel's own good. If they did anything else, they were getting away from what God's intention was for them, which he spoke in Exodus 4, verse 6, when he says to Moses, he says, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. you know, and if Pharaoh refuses to let Israel go, then I'll slay his son, even his firstborn. But what has God just said there? He said, Israel is my firstborn. And what is the firstborn? What does the firstborn get? They get the greatest inheritance that God possibly has, that the father has. That's what the firstborn gets. Well, what's the greatest inheritance God could possibly give anyone? It's to be the bride of Christ. What he's saying is, I'm going to be preparing you as a nation for the next 1,600 years to transfer from Moses to Christ. You are going to be the bride of my son. And this law, this covenant is preparing you for that. So they were to have the, and they were told in Exodus 19, verse 6, they would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, what does that sound like? That is talking to them 1,600 years before the fact. Peter, in 2 Peter 2:9, talks about it when the opportunity is right before them. Ye are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. There it is in the reality in Exodus 19. Here it is in the preparation stage. Well, at the first advent, at Jesus' first advent, all Israel was supposed to transfer from Moses to Christ. In John 1, 11 and 12, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, gave he power to become the sons of God. That's where they were headed. That's where they're supposed to be going. This was the one true religion, and this is where it was taking them. It's just the majority of the Jews couldn't make the trip. That's where the bus was going, and most of them pulled the brake and got off. In fact, they thought this new religion, this idea, you know, this thing that Jesus was the Son of God, that this was blasphemy. Well, after Jesus' ascension and Pentecost, things changed for those who were following this new, true path. The Jews who were now following Christ and doing exactly what the preparation in Exodus 19, verse 6 was, becoming a kingdom of priests and holy nation, they found that they were no longer in the majority. Now, before, whenever the Jews would be in Galilee, or they'd be in Judea, they're amongst Jews. Now, there were Romans there, too, but at least the Jews are amongst Jews. You're a Jew, you're at home. Everybody's a Jew. No persecution, you're right where you should be. You're very comfortable. But now, all of a sudden, or if you're a Roman in the Roman Empire, everybody has whatever pagan religion that is. But now, what is happening, there's a big change. These Christians find out, instead of being the majority religion where they lived, they're now the persecuted minority. Was this to be a surprise? Well, Jesus had told them, blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you, say all manner of evil against you for my sake. Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven. Matthew 10:25. If they've called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? John 16:2. They shall put you out of the synagogues. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God's service. 1 Peter 4:12. Think it not strange that concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice. Strange? Jesus told you this was going to happen. You know what this covenant of sacrifice. Rejoice in as much as you are partakers of Christ's sufferings. Colossians 1:24. Rejoice in my sufferings for you and fill out that which is behind of the afflictions of Christ. Romans 8:17. If so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. 2 Timothy 3:12. Yea, all that will live godly in Christ shall suffer persecution. This is the guarantee. The persecution is a guarantee. It's not a maybe, it's a guarantee. In other words, you can't have the glorification, you can't be of the body of Christ without the suffering, without the persecutions, without the sacrifice. So the difficult way that the Christians were getting into, they knew it. They had been warned. They were told about that. So what should their attitude toward their persecutors be? Well, Jesus covered that too. Matthew 5:44. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them with which despitefully use you and persecute you. So the persecutions would actually strengthen the church. It would give them clarity. Adversity brings clarity, brings strength. The followers of Christ would be the misunderstood, persecuted minority among both the Jews and the Gentiles, both of whom required religious uniformity and would tolerate no deviations from their religions. But this is one of the main ways that God would develop, test, and prove the true church, and prove to each one of them, just how much the fidelity to the truth meant to them. And they all understood this. In pagan Rome, the emperor was Pontifex Maximus. He insisted that his subjects worship the entire pantheon of gods. Now, what does this mean? Well, the pantheon was this big temple, and it had statues of all these gods in there. And this pantheon was sort of like a smorgasbord of gods. What would you like to worship today? We've got Jupiter, Juno, Mars, Venus, Minerva, Neptune, Ceres, Diana, Bacchus, Mercury, Vesta. So what? Suppose you're going off to war. You're a soldier. You're going to go off on a campaign in Germania or something. Oh, you can sacrifice to Mars, the god of war. Suppose you're a young lady. You're looking for a husband. Maybe you want to worship Venus. You're going into a difficult, you're a lawyer. You're going into a difficult trial. Well, how about Minerva, the goddess of wisdom? You're going to have a party. Bacchus, the god of wine, the god of happy hour. You got a little something for everybody. But the thing is that this, when you were in every citizen, when they're worshiping these gods, they show the support for the emperor as Pontifex Maximus, because this absolute godocrat is the one who is being guided and directed and blessed by these gods. So when you support those gods, you're supporting the emperor and the empire. That's how it worked. It was all one. This is why it was illegal to come up with a different religion. This is why Paul, when he's on Mars Hill, he's talking about the unknown God. Because if he brought up a new one, let me tell you about a different God than all the ones you already are acknowledging. Well, that's illegal. He'd be thrown in prison, most likely killed. So, they were already told, here's your government, here's your religion, no need for any options here. Well, how do they show this, the support? Well, I might say, brethren, how often do you eat? We just had a meal. Usually you eat every day. It's good practice every day, probably 3 times a day. Well, this support was actually shown in their daily life, in the meat sacrificed to idols, because what the practice was, is if you were rich, you had some food of your own, you'd take it to the priest at whatever shrine, to whatever god you want. He'd take maybe a chip of the meat, sacrifice it to, let's say, Mars or Jupiter, sacrifice it, give you the rest of it, and now when you ate that meat, you automatically got the blessing of that god. Automatically. And suppose you weren't rich, you're a laborer. You live hand to mouth, and every day you have to buy whatever food at the market. Well, that food at the market has already been sacrificed to idols. It doesn't have the FDA stamp on it. It's got the STI, already sacrificed to idols. So when you buy the food and you eat it, you are now acknowledging support for these gods and for the emperor. Well, this mysterious sacrificed meat would be returned, and you eat it, and this is automatic. I mean, go home, have a party, have an orgy, doesn't matter. You automatically get the blessing of this god. It has nothing to do with faith or piety or righteousness. It's just the procedure you go through, this mysterious procedure. In fact, this was called the Mysterion. And just about all the, the Christians would reveal themselves as to who there are because they were refusing to eat this meat sacrificed to idols. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Acts 21, and there's a discussion of it in the First Council of the Church in Acts 15. they were supposed to keep themselves from meat sacrificed to idols. But keep in mind, in the mind of the Christians, this was not a political decision. This was a religious decision. They weren't rebelling against the empire in their minds. They were just saying, we're making a choice. We're making a religious decision. But to the Romans, they did not separate religion from the empire. To the Romans, if you didn't eat this meat sacrificed to idols, this was open rebellion against the empire itself. This was treason. So Christians had a very tough time in the first two stages of the church, both Ephesus and Smyrna. Well, especially during the Diocletian period we talked about before, the Christians were bitterly cursed, persecuted. But over time, pagan Rome was losing its ability to control the masses with the pagan religions. It was generally known amongst the educated people that the pagan gods were simply superstitious means to control the ignorant. And they knew that a lot of the so-called miracles the priests performed, they were just magic tricks that they had arranged to overawe the people. But amongst the Jews, the more educated they were, the more they realized their religion was real. And certainly amongst the Christians, the more they studied, the more they knew, the more that they realized this is the real religion. This is the one true God. Well, in February of 313, Constantine and Licinius, they met in Milan and they had the Edict of Milan, and they stated the Christians should be allowed to follow their faith without oppression. And gradually Christianity became the religion of the empire with the Council of Nice in 325. We have the third stage of the church, Pergamos, earthly elevation. The apostate church was now gaining favor. 533, as we mentioned 2 days ago, Justinian was now, he recognized the Bishop of Rome as the head of the church. And the whole idea is Justinian wanted uniformity of the empire. He was going to have a war with the Goths. He needed Italy. He wanted uniformity. And that uniform faith had to be the Orthodox faith, Nicene faith. That was the only thing that was permitted. Well, gradually, the Pope was recognized. He had been recognized as the head of the church. Christianity became the majority religion and the only official religion by 800. And anybody with a different religion other than the Jews would not be tolerated. Well, Christians now became the persecutors, so-called Christians, Catholic Church. They become the persecutors rather than the persecuted. Sacrificing for Christ in the minds of the Catholic Church, which is now the vast majority, had now stopped for these politically correct Catholic Christians. Nicene Christianity was no longer a choice or a decision. It was an obligation from birth to death. Infant baptism was a way for parents to demonstrate their fidelity to the empire, because it was the empire church that would baptize their children into a religion that really nobody understood. It could be done only by priests sanctioned by the empire, and failure to do this for your children was considered a treasonous rebellion against king, church, God, and country. So if you're going to take a religion and have it apply to absolutely everybody in society, what you have to do is you have to dumb it down to the lowest common denominator. So religious rites were reduced to that, the lowest common denominator, to the point where there was no need for faith or understanding or piety. It was merely necessary to go through the motions, just turn the crank, just do whatever you're supposed to do, whether you know anything about it or not, and that's it. In other words, baptizing your children was now like branding cattle. Brand of the empire is on my child and on me. The prime example of this is the Lord's Supper, which was reduced to the Mass. take a look at it. A fee is paid. The priest, and only the priest, can say whatever magic words, you know, we know what they are, but they say the magic words to create and perform the sacrifice. The recipient doesn't even pick it up. He just opens his mouth. The priest pops it in the mouth and the wafer, and the recipient automatically receives the blessing of whatever God that is. Note that there's no need for faith or piety or righteousness, and it's designed to be a daily procedure. You know, some really devout Catholics, how often do they go to Mass? Every day. Just like eating. Note in the Mass, the words that Jesus said, "Take, eat, this is my body," that's been removed from the Mass because that implies a decision on the part of the recipient. No, there are no decisions. You open your mouth, the priest just pops it in there. There were no decisions. This was obligatory. By going to the Mass, the people endorsed the clergy and the emperor by acknowledging the God which guided him and gave him his divine right. An absence from the Mass showed a lack of support. Having a different religion was open treason. Well, the Mass is a sacrament. We're all familiar with that term. A sacrament. But the procedure sounds a whole lot like the Mysterion, doesn't it? Well, it turns out if you look at the Latin translation of the Greek word Mysterion, it's sacramentum. The sacraments are exactly the same as the meat sacrificed to idols. The Lord's Supper was intentionally made as shallow as the Mysterion because it's the lowest common denominator. It has to apply to absolutely everybody. No thinking. Thinking is totally optional. Leave your brain at the door. In fact, we prefer you don't think, or else you might question things. Both were mindless procedures, which show support for a monolithic society unified in unquestioned religious and civil authority. Remember, God had said, "Behold, the days come," in Amos 8:11. "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord God, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread nor of thirst of water, but of hearing the words of the Lord." And, of course, the heyday of the Catholic Church, that's what we're talking about. The true church saw the corruption of Christianity, the elimination of Christian principles, the eradication of true sacrifice, and used its only option left, which was to flee into the wilderness. This is shown by the life of Elijah in 1 Kings 16 when Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil. He took a wife and served Baal and worshipped him. And in 1 Kings 17, Elijah says, "There shall not be dew or rain these years, but according to my word." And, of course, he was in this wilderness for 3.5 years, picturing these 1,260 days that we're all familiar with. On the second volume, page 256, there's a chart showing Elijah's life as it corresponds to this 3.5 years. And it's 3.5 years as it corresponds to the 1,260 years of the church in the wilderness condition. This is when religion had been degraded to the lowest common denominator for pagan Rome and for papal Rome. They just took on, you know, the old Holy Roman Empire, but really Christianity had become a pagan religion with pagan rites. All who professed, and this is from the Man of Sin chapter, all who professed Christ were expected to conform to the usages and regulations of the gradually self-exalting hierarchy. Error, always more popular than truth, when exalted to influence and power, they hunted down, proscribed, and made disreputable the truth and all who held it. Well, as the papal power grew, the true Christians became targets because they threatened the very fabric of society. Even though the true Christians were simply making religious decisions. Now, note the papacy never said, "Well, tell you what, let's get the heretics in the room and let's have a debate. We'll talk about the Catholic doctrine and then they can talk about their doctrine. We'll discuss, we'll open the scriptures and see who's right." That would never happen because it would show the Catholic Church is a sham. It would just show that what they have is absolutely wrong. They would never agree to something like that. So the only thing they could do is kill the true Christians. Even though these Christians were making religious decisions of faith and fidelity to God, these were interpreted as treason against the state. And this included the Arians, the Donatists, the Albigenses, Waldenses, Anabaptists, Catharers, Huguenots, and the list goes on and on and on. They simply wanted the liberty to make an honest decision about how to properly follow Christ. They were called heretics. Well, the word heretic is an interesting word. It comes from the Greek herein, and it means to exercise an option in the presence of alternatives. To exercise an option in the presence of alternatives. Does that sound so terrible? Well, the Empire Church told them, you don't have any options. You don't have any choices. We already told you what you're going to believe. Here's the emperor. Here's the church. That's what you're going to do from birth to death. You deviate from that. You die. We will burn you at the stake. Nebuchadnezzar said, you deviate from this religion, the fiery furnace. Same thing. Exactly the same thing. Jesus had said in John 15:19, if you are of the world would love his own, but because you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. Well, these heretics could see that the world was no longer something that was outside of and around the church, but the world had become identical with the church. There was no difference between worldly, fallen behavior, and Christian behavior, because the empire and the Catholic Church had made them the same. It made them the same. In fact, this is so true that the Christians, true Christians who spoke of piety and true Christian conduct, became suspect. And this is a quote from this book, from then, and which is a quote from a court transcript. Says, when certain people were being investigated for suspected Anabaptist leanings, this testimony was offered. Because their children are being so carefully and devoutly reared, and because they do not have the practice of cursing and swearing, therefore they are suspected of being Anabaptists. In other words, doing the right thing and trying to live a Christian life is now the wrong thing. And you'll be suspect by nominal Christian society. Conversely, we read of people cleared of Anabaptist leanings by their bad deportment. All you'd have to do is show you're a sinner, a terrible sinner, to go, oh, you're just like us. You're one of the good guys. You're not an Anabaptist who we should burn at the stake. So the Waldenses, the Albigenses, and others, these folks didn't believe in transubstantiation. They didn't believe that the Pope was the head of the church, but the Lord. They knew that Mary was not the mother of God. In fact, all of these things were well known in the year 1025. It's well documented in history. They realized that there are no sacraments in the Holy Church by which one can attain salvation. Baron Garius, this is around 1025, he knew that the Lord's Supper is not the actual body and blood, not the body of the Lord, but it's a symbol. In fact, their idea, they were essentially saying, well, what kind of a moron would you have to be to think that that's the actual body and blood of Christ? I mean, suppose you were actually there the night of the institution of the memorial, and this was the piece of bread that Jesus is holding up, and he says, this is my body broken for you. Now, if somebody was really thick and didn't understand, they said, no, hold on, Jesus. This is your body. That's a piece of bread. And Jesus would say, wait a second. This is a symbol. Don't you see? This is a metaphor. This is a symbol. Well, the folks who are the true Christians in the wilderness, they realize this has to be a symbol. You'd have to be really thick to think that's the actual body and blood of Christ. They knew this very well. Well, the true Christians, especially the Anabaptists, they became known as the defenseless Christians because they did not fight back when persecuted. They were harmless as doves. They were the conscientious objectors of their day. In fact, by the time we get to Waldo and the Thyatira period of the church, somewhere around the middle 1100s, the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, was in full control. This was the height of the Dark Ages. The Latin is now the mysterious dead language understood only by the priests when they do the Mass. Well, note this. This is interesting. The Church of Thyatira, this is in the fourth stage of the Church, where in Revelation 2:19 and 20, to the angel of Thyatira, write this. I know your works, charity, service, faith, patience, but I have a few things against you, because you suffered that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess, to teach and seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed to idols. To eat things sacrificed to idols. How can that be? This is in the middle 1100s. Paganism and the meat sacrificed to idols has been eradicated from the Roman Empire for 400 or 500 years. So how could this apply? Well, the meat sacrificed to idols is the Mass. That's what that's talking about. They've turned this mindless procedure of the Mass. That's what it's referring to. Well, progress was made with the doctrine of, with the work of Wycliffe and Luther, but these did not acknowledge the terrible error of church union with the civil rulers. Luther felt he still needed support of the kings. But it was too early for come out of for my people. They felt society, that God wanted society to be church and state, where the church made the rules and the magistrates would then enforce them. In fact, this is exactly what Revelation 12 is saying. The dragon chased the woman because Michael, who as God, you know, the papacy is under control and saying, okay, civil power, you go and chase these heretics, get rid of them. That's exactly what that's saying. So even with Wycliffe and Luther, both had this idea of a Christian society, a Christian world, rather than the correct idea of the church as the sacrificing little flock. Well, during the work of these reformers, the Waldenses, the Anabaptists, and the others continued to be persecuted and killed and burned at the stake, because they were still seen as a threat to society, threat to the government, because they were doing things outside of this sanctioned church state. But the doctrines of the true Christians were powerful, especially as the Reformation continued and Europeans began to read and think for themselves. The reason I say that is it's well documented that when an Anabaptist would be burned at the stake, whether it's amongst Protestants or it's amongst Catholics, the problem that they had with burning an Anabaptist at the stake is it would take 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes for the flames finally to get up and kill them. And during that time, they were witnessing the truth. And in that 10 or 15, if you had 15 minutes left to live, what are you going to talk about? Well, in that 15 minutes, they may be killing one Anabaptist, but that individual has now created a dozen more. Because the things they were saying were such powerful truths that was converting others to understanding the Anabaptist doctrine. Well, eventually they found that they had to gag the Anabaptists so they couldn't talk because their words were so powerful. Well, the doctrine of justification by faith, which our dear brother Martin Luther realized and shared, it actually backfired to a certain extent. Because before Luther, the Catholic doctrine was justification by works, which means if you want to go to heaven, you want to avoid hell, and you don't have money to buy indulgences, you have only one choice. You have to be good. You have to do good works. That's how you go to heaven. That's how you avoid hell. But note, this was the religion which was down to the lowest common denominator. The lowest common denominator. Everybody had some idea of Christ. They believed in Christ to some extent. Well, when the doctrine of justification came out, many folks had said, well, you mean I don't have to do good works anymore? Have you ever shared with people, oh, there's no hell? And probably two-thirds of the people say, well, why would anybody be good? This is sort of the same kind of thing. Oh, justification by faith? I believe in Jesus. That's all I need? Great. I don't have to do good works anymore. And now the moral climate of especially of Northern Europe, where the Reformation really took hold, justification by faith, the moral climate was degraded. Because good works were now downgraded, and this revealed the true Christians even more, because the true Christians were still trying to live a life of piety. Note that the true Christians who were in the wilderness could see the harlot for who she was, not only as the Antichrist, but the harlot as well. Whereas Luther was not in the wilderness. He was in Babylon. He was trying to reform it from within. He couldn't really see the harlot. He kept the idea of church and state together as one. Well, those in the wilderness knew that the followers of Christ must always be the minority, or else the true relationship to Christ would cease. Finally, with the work of Napoleon, the world began to change. Papal power to persecute was ending. The Bible Society sprang up. Those from the wilderness could emerge from this deep, deep, dark period of wilderness. They could emerge from hiding and seclusion. Song of Solomon 8:5. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? Well, that's where their strength was. They were leaning upon their beloved. They'd relied on the word of God and the example of Jesus during those 1260 years. They were given those two wings of the great eagle, the Old and New Testament. During these long years of their faithfulness and persecution. Well, the Enlightenment continued with the Miller movement and the work of the seventh messenger. Note that Brother Russell was not a minister in any established church. He was also in the wilderness. Not the dark, dark wilderness of the 1260 years, but he was still in the wilderness. And brethren, we're in the wilderness. We're not in the city. We're in the wilderness. The city where we want to be the new Jerusalem. We want that city whose builder and maker is God. Well, Brother Russell saw and understood this wilderness condition, and that the great whore was there even through the, he understood about the great whore even though the 1260 years were over. In Daniel 12:7, and I heard a man clothed with linen, which was upon the waters of the river, and he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and sware by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half. And here's Brother Russell really looking at this flood, the French Revolution, and he was making sense out of what was before and what was after. And he brought that to us. Now, Revelation 17, 1 through 3 and verse 5. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying, come unto me, come hither, I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Now, last evening, I was in the Philippines, not literally, but in the spirit, because a dear brother took me there. I saw pictures, I heard words, I actually heard the sounds. In the spirit, I was there. Well, this is an angel who says, come hither. So in verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, in the spirit, in our minds, in our thoughts, in our comprehension. Brother Russell didn't have a time machine, but he could write down the words that we could now see and understand. He could put us there in the spirit. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Brethren, we have the privilege to be carried away in the spirit, in our understanding, to see that great whore and the fornication with the kings of the earth. We are so thankful that so many of our faithful brethren, and many, many more than I first thought, were willing to be heretics, to make a decision, to make a choice for the right way, and to live their faith even when it meant a death sentence. And they knew it. Dear brethren, may we all be heretics and continue to evaluate, to decide, to choose, and to make the truth our own. A wise man once said, you've never really lived until you've found something you're willing to die for. Brethren, we've all found the most wonderful thing to die for.